This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today I am with
Colin Dyer.
And I am Stuart Burks. Okay, now Colin, you had a lot of involvement with the showgrounds in Palmerston North.
Yes, well, of course, the showgrounds is one of the oldest existing facilities in Palmerston North. Was first set up in 1886 when the first AMP show occurred. Some gifted land by the Minister of Lands of the Crown was given to the AMP Association in early 1886. And after clearing quite a lot of trees and stumps, they had their first show, as I mentioned, in 1886. The AMP Association worked on annual shows, and they had a winter show as well for a number of years. By the turn of the century, they'd incorporated the Manawatu Rugby Football Union as a user, and there were a few other sporting groups and other people who used the place, but mainly it was used for stock shows and AMP shows.
So who was the AMP organisation?
Yeah, the AMP is the Agricultural and Pastoral Organisation, and these were set up all around the colonies from the immigrants from Great Britain. And so they were very much popular groups of associations and farmers, mainly rural people in Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and other colonies as well. So throughout New Zealand in the 1870s and 1880s, these A&P associations were a way of farmers getting together to compete their sheep, their wool, their produce, their horses, and also to bring to some extent the country to the town. And so in most of the major centres of New Zealand, then AMP associations existed. And even today, 120 or so years later, they're still quite prominent in places like Canterbury, Dannevirke, some of the rural sort of based areas. Manawatu and West Coast AMP Association was formed in 1886.
So that's a sort of voluntary group or a business organisation?
Entirely voluntary, although they did generally later have a paid secretary. But no, it was very much a voluntary group. And prior to each annual show, they'd have a team of volunteers putting up pens and horse jumps and all sorts of things. And even in the days that I was involved, from 1987, they'd put up nearly 1,000 sheep pens just for the three-day show. So lots of voluntary efforts in all these different sections that the AMP associations had. However, by about 1950, the Palmerston North AMP showgrounds, as it was called in those days, were starting to look somewhat derelict. You know, the buildings were really sort of a bit ramshackled. The place wasn't really being used very often, apart from the annual show and one or two other events, a little bit by the rugby union, but the fields weren't in great condition. So the place was really run down, and the problem was that as the population in the rural areas surrounding the city of Palmerston North were beginning to decrease in terms of the urban population, then I guess a lot of the support and entries for shows and the patronage were starting to drop off somewhat. So in 1972, The deputy mayor at the time, Gordon Brown, along with some other people like John Bolt, who was a very prominent councillor in Palmerston North, got the idea that perhaps they could, in a sense, purchase the AMP showgrounds from the AMP Association, give them some rights of use, and develop or redevelop the prime space right there in Cuba Street into something that really would benefit the whole community more than just an AMP showgrounds. And they particularly were prominent in promoting sport and recreation in our city, particularly John Bolt, who is very much aligned with the establishment of the Lido and many other facilities, and Gordon Brown, who was very prominent in our city with the Consumers Co-op and various other things. So they did this negotiation deal with the people in the AMP Association, and in 1974 a special act of Parliament called the Palmerston North Showgrounds Act became enforceable, and this essentially provided for the City Council to expend a substantial sum of money at that time over the next 10 years in developing the showgrounds into something of a more multi-use recreation area, but reserving for the AMP Association up to 14 days of use each year. That turned out to be a very successful deal, and I can imagine it wouldn't have been that easy to do at the time, because there would have been a lot of AMP Association members spread out throughout the region that might have felt that they were selling off the silver somewhat. But in actual fact, I think there's no question looking back that it was a deal of considerable foresight, and really everyone was a winner.
So were they really just using the ground for about 14 days a year anyway beforehand?
They weren't actually using it for 14 days, but they decided that 14 days would give them opportunities of use that perhaps was potentially available to them.
So in the past they had the grounds all year, but really got just one short bit of use?
Yes, and a little bit of rental from a few other users. But the problem was they weren't in a position to expend the sums of money that were really required to make this prime site something of an attraction and a useful sort of community asset. So, yep, the City Council took it over, and in doing so, they created what was called the Palmerston North Showgrounds Board of Control, set up in 1974. Again, the first chairman was Gordon Brown. And one of the members that joined that board late in 1974 was Bernard Ford, who later went on to serve as chairman and was for some almost 30 years a board member or chairperson of the Board of Control. So the council had three representatives. The Manawatu Rugby Union was provided with two representatives on the board. The AMP Association had three, and there were to be one and later two representatives from various of the recreation and sporting user groups. So a fairly interesting composite board, which wasn't always that easy to manage in some ways, because they all had their own particular interests, and what suited rugby didn't necessarily suit, say, stock cars, who also had a representative on the board, motorsport. And of course, what AMP wanted was quite different in many respects from what perhaps the Basketball Association or the Table Tennis Association or the Gymnastics or somebody else might want. So yes, it was a rather delicate manoeuvre quite often to get everyone to agree on certain things.
But the facility would have actually enabled the growth of a lot of those other activities, you think?
No question. In fact, what a wonderful success it turned out to be. Really stimulated, I guess, by that extra money that the council was able to invest. And so the whole motorsport speedway track was formed, some with council money, some with speedway money. All the red tin corrugated fencing and barbed wire which surrounded the whole site in Cuba and Pascal Street and Waldegrave Street was progressively replaced with landscaped sort of grounds. The fields were drained so that they could be used better for rugby and other outdoor sports, because certainly in the wintertime they were just very muddy sort of fields. And the thing got a real boost when in 1979 the council agreed to construct the fund and construct the Manawatū Sports Stadium, or the Rainbow Stadium as it was commonly called by a lot of people at that time. And this was the biggest single-span sporting facility indoor arena in Australasia. It was equivalent to something like 50 houses in terms of area, over 10,000 square metres. It had five basketball courts within that configuration. And the very interesting construction with the laminated wooden beams were very intended to be earthquake-proof, and a great deal of thought went into creating this building.
You say intended to be?
Yeah, the spans were specially made in Nelson, and there was quite a story of how they were all shipped over and brought here to Palmerston North, which created a lot of interest at the time. So yes, this big sports stadium was a huge advantage and a big asset to the whole showgrounds. And from that point on, we began to attract a lot of international and national events, concerts, things like the Shadows came and played there. We began to get quite a few prominent national and even international things like netball tests, basketball events. And because they'd decided to put in a flooring which was composed of Mondo rubber, which was very innovative at the time, a layering of special rubber surface.
So what was that like?
It was a bit like the hockey,
artificial
courts, artificial turf, quite thick rubber in particular layers that was particularly constructed to enable trucks to drive over it, to be able to play tennis on it, to be able to play netball tests on it, to have sheep and cattle on it during AMP shows. So extremely versatile. rubber flooring.
So for tennis, what would... I mean, you hear of playing on grass or clay courts and so on. Is this a different category of tennis? Or?
I'm not sure, but I can say that it was of such value that Davis Cup tennis player played in there. And certainly while I was there, we had during about 3 or 4 years a regular national tennis league playing, where I think there were five different venues in New Zealand, this being one of them, at the very top class of tennis. So yes, it was very much considered to be excellent for almost everything.
Yeah. And they were well supported by the public there. You have these events and you get big crowds along?
I'll come to the events in a moment. Okay. But just touching again on the surface area, on the surface conditions, Sandra Edge, who was one of the most prominent netball Silver Ferns at the time, had told me on several occasions that it was the very best surface that she played on anywhere in the world. So we got some great comments about the surface, and it was only in much more recent times when some of the codes demanded that timber floor had to be used, that we created a portable floor, and then subsequently in more recent times a wooden floor. But of course wooden floors would not have given us the versatility of use that was required by the Act, which meant that we had to provide a facility which was okay to be used by animals as well as for sporting. So quite a difficult assignment and a particularly well done job. I arrived at the showgrounds as manager in November 1987, shortly after the Rugby World Cup, the very first Rugby World Cup, just a month or so after that. And in 1986, they'd had the Royal AMP show there, which came round every 4 or 5 years. So at that stage, it was starting to attract some pretty reasonable events. In that first year or so when I arrived, the The finances of the place weren't in particularly good shape. There was a $20,000 overdraft just to enable wages and things to be paid. And the debtors were very high, and a whole lot of other KPIs weren't in particularly good shape at all. But anyway, in the first year, I was able to eliminate the $20,000 overdraft debt, reduce our debtors from 61% to 15%. We increased our turnover in that first year by 21%, and we reduced our costs by 3%. So from that time on, through 1987 until I left in 2002, we continued to really develop the facility as a multi-use facility at international level.
So what was the turnaround, or what brought that about? You brought in bigger events, or you got more...
I guess it was a combination of a whole lot of things. A lot of it had simply to do with developing the facility and the culture of the place as a service orientated facility, rather than lots of rules and what you couldn't do rather than what you could do. And it was also about trying to be innovative in respect of attracting new events and different things. Mm. So that during that time, we progressively continued to focus on local community sport and recreation, because that was the main purpose of the Act. So every year we ensured that not less than 50% of all of the hours of use were focused on providing local sport and recreation at minimal costs. And on, at the other end of the scale, we created a tiered rental program whereby commercial users paid substantially more than recreation users, and social users paid a little less, and exhibition users also paid commercial rates.
Okay. So to bring in a different focus like this, you had a board that was people representing the different sort of sporting groups and so on. Presumably, were they really focused on their own area rather than the broad direction of the showgrounds, do you think?
Cool. I think in many senses that was the case, and that's why they were there. The city councillors were the ones that could provide that balance. So my job as manager was to constantly negotiate between each of these parties to arrive at the sort of outcome we wanted. And not only that, it was about innovative things like talking to New Zealand Rugby League, who at that time only could play at Addington Showgrounds in Christchurch and Kailua Park in Auckland. They weren't permitted to use any ground that was used or dominated by rugby unions throughout New Zealand.
Why was that?
Well, this is all part of what was happening in those days. I mean, rugby union was very, very desirous of making sure that rugby league didn't get, you know, too much of a foothold in. So apart from the west coast of New Zealand and Huntley and a few sort of coal mining areas, rugby league was not so prominent. So I was able to do a deal with the New Zealand Rugby League, but more particularly with my colleagues in the Manawatū Rugby Football Union, who did have the foresight and could see that if we attracted more major sporting events, then we were going to get better investment from the council and other funders, and that they would benefit in the end.
Yeah.
And we were able to achieve that. But we were the first in New Zealand to do that.
Because that's why I was it a big struggle? You got a lot of resistance?
Of course. I mean, you can imagine. And this was entirely what happened through all of these different things, is that if I wanted to bring a major event in, say like a concert, I had to negotiate with the regular users who already had bookings throughout the year for their regular sports. And I had to convince them that giving up this particular date to allow me to do something else meant that I could keep their rentals low, because I needed to have, from time to time, commercial events that paid substantially more. Okay. So it was a lot of politics and negotiating and persuading.
And the commercial ones were sort of locked into certain dates, was it? People were on tour or something and said, we can be here in this this window.
So quite right. But very often you might only get 2 or 3 months' notice and you've already committed to other regular users for tournaments or their regular, you know, Friday night basketball or whatever it was.
But the charge for them will be a lot higher?
Very much so. So that keeping the regular users, the sporting users' rentals low was the whole, was the carrot, as it were. Yes. Otherwise, if I couldn't have a balance of commercial events, then obviously their rentals had to continue. So, you know, I'm very proud of the fact that in the first 9 years, the community sporting users' rentals were not increased at all. Mm. And in some cases, they decreased. Okay. And so I could demonstrate by doing this and by attracting major events and events that brought visitors to our cities, conferences and such like, that we were generating activity right around the city, and which in the end benefited everyone. But it was very difficult at the start because that was not at all the philosophy that I first entered into.
But was there much change required? You've got a concert coming in. Was there much needed to be done in, say, changing seating and flooring and so on?
Yes, the seating was always a difficult thing because the Manawatu Sports Stadium did not have any permanent seating. The seating was entirely composed of tiered seating on wheels that we could wheel outside or inside. So if we had an event around the stock car track or around the rugby field, we could move the seating by tractor or forklift out to the fields. And similarly, if we had a netball test or a concert or whatever, we could configure the seating within the sports stadium or other facilities. So that was one of the advantages in the beginning, but later, as people wanted more comfort, of course we had to do something a bit better than that. Mm-hmm. But talking about seating, when I first attracted the very first Super Rugby game in the world here in Palmerston North in 1996, we had the very first Super Rugby game at the Showgrounds Oval. I had to guarantee that there would be not less than 15,000 seats. The grandstand had 3,650, I think it was, at the time. It was a nice grandstand, being built in 1986. But, of course, that left a lot of seats for me to find. And so that's where I had to be resourceful, and I had to go around all the schools in the Manawatu and find tiered seatings that I could truck in and crane in and bolt in and chain, rope, anything I could do to make sure that the
health and safety requirements now, could you have...
Well, probably that would be marginal, but it was fair to say we had to be, you know, had to make sure they were safe. And so they were inspected by the City Council building and inspectors at the time. Perhaps the standards were slightly different, but I'm just saying to illustrate, despite the handicaps we had in terms of not having the physical things that we needed to do the job, we somehow frequently managed to get these events by doing some very innovative things.
Okay. What about the sound and lighting and acoustics and so on?
Yeah, now that's another good story too, because just going back to the Rainbow Stadium.
Why was it called Rainbow?
Because on the front of the building, which was a huge building, of course, as I say, about the equivalent of 50 houses, the painter at the time had not been given clear instructions as to what the front-facing Pascal Street part of the half-moon shape of the front of the curved building should be. So on his own initiative, he used up a whole lot of different pots of paint, and so we had a rainbow effect of blue, yellow, orange, red in rainbow colours across the front of it. And that was a very distinctive thing and made us quite different from anywhere else in New Zealand, and of course is the reason why it was called the Rainbow Stadium. The lighting levels for events is very, very important, and so you know, sometimes I was quite involved in improving or developing lighting levels, because what badminton wanted for a national tournament would be quite different from, say, what an AMP show or a concert might want. With concerts and entertainment, generally we had to bring masses of lighting in, and that was generally part of the whole concert tour, where they have lots of trucks of equipment and they come in and put it all up. And because our curved beams were really good for hanging all sorts of lights and sound and gear off, then, you know, we had all the facilities to do that. And when the stadium had been constructed, they had enough foresight to create a lot of extra power there, which we sometimes used to the absolute maximum, but was sufficient. Looking at the outdoor space, we were only the second rugby ground in New Zealand to put outdoor lighting in. And again, you know, that was quite innovative at the time for us and for Palmerston North. The very first game televised under lights there was in 1989, when the New Zealand juniors played the Australian juniors in a rugby league test, and we simply turned the stock car lights around, focused them on the field, and set up a night game which was televised directly to Australia. Fortunately,
so now you turn the stock car lights around. So you've got the stock car track was around the outside of the rugby track, and the lights were just pointing down, so you turn them around and they're pointing in on the...
Exactly so, yes, yeah. So you get a big crane in and you get someone up on the crane and you've got to unbolt all the lights, turn them all around, quite a couple of days sort of exercise to do. But anyway, yes, it was certainly done. But of course, it's quite amazing to think that we managed to have a televised game back to Australia using just a few stock car lights. I couldn't believe it when the first time I went to the Melbourne Cricket Ground and saw 136 lamps each on six towers, and we had about five lamps on four towers. So it was very inadequate. But however, we managed to do the game, and that set us up for the next part of trying to get an improvement. And I must say, one of our city councillors, Vern Chittleborough, who was very prominent in the city at that time, and particularly in sporting and recreation things, he managed to convince the council to spend some money out of a particular fund. And as I say, we were the second ground in New Zealand to be able to put in night lighting. And yeah, I learnt a lot about lux levels and vertical levels and all sorts of things to do with lighting. And at that time, we thought that 500 vertical lux was, you know, state of the art, and so we were able to do night games of league and rugby, as I say, very much innovative for New Zealand.
What about the acoustics for the concerts inside?
Yeah, acoustically, the stadium was quite a bit better than people perhaps gave it credit for. And we had some very prominent, you know, rock stars and people come quite regularly. And I can recall on one occasion when the National Orchestra was playing in there, because at that time the Opera House had been closed and there was still debate as to whether the Regent was going to be refitted or quite what was going to be the concert venue for the city. And so for about 3 or 4 years, we had all those sort of cultural events in the stadium as well, graduation ceremonies, school prize givings, and even events such as the National Orchestra. In this particular case, I remember speaking to the conductor, who was the guest conductor of the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra at the time. He was a Canadian of considerable experience, an older man, and he said this was the second best acoustics facility he'd ever played in.
That's very impressive.
It is impressive, isn't it?
That's very good. Yes. Not what you'd expect, but
not at all. And the general public really were surprised to hear that sort of comment. Not that I was particularly canvassing it. He offered that comment to me.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.